and welcome to The History of Philosophy in China by Peter Adamson and Karen Lai, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, Open Season, the Historical Context. What historical circumstances are best for producing philosophy? The answer might seem obvious: a period of peace, stability, and prosperity, enabling intellectuals to retire to their studies and contemplate higher truths without political or economic troubles to distract them. But perhaps that just breeds complacence and conservatism. Disruption could actually be helpful by inspiring innovative and groundbreaking ideas as new solutions are proposed to deal with pressing problems. On the other hand, total chaos doesn't sound like a great recipe for careful reflection either. What we're looking for is probably a situation where events are unstable enough to provoke serious reflection without causing such devastation that no one has sufficient composure to engage in that reflection. The history of philosophy in Europe might support that hypothesis. Plato was a privileged aristocrat writing in the wake of the Peloponnesian War, and about two millennia later, the scholars and scientists of the Enlightenment were reacting to the wars of religion. Further east, the story of the Buddha encapsulates the point in a single anecdote. He lived much of his life as pampered royalty and was only led to philosophical reflection after venturing beyond his palace walls and being confronted with illness and death. Yet there is no better illustration of philosophy as an elite reaction to unsettled times than classical Chinese philosophy. Several of its characteristic movements emerged in a period whose name says it all, the time of the Warring States, or Jianguo, which runs from 481 to 221 BCE. With this designation, historians are picking out a 2.5-century era as one of conflict and disunity, and tacitly contrasting it to what came before and after. Let's start with a traditional account of what came before. The part of modern-day China we're concerned with here is really only the area around the Yellow River. The period of political rule, known as the Shang Dynasty, lasted from about 1600 BCE until the middle of the 11th century BCE. We won't have much to say about that period on this podcast because it produced so little surviving literature. Around the year 1045, the Shang were displaced by the Zhou Dynasty, also called the Western Zhou, for reasons that will become clear in a moment. Depending on what you're willing to count as philosophy, it is already in this very early period that we start to see the emergence of philosophical texts. In particular, two texts that were important for the history of Chinese philosophy were set down in their original forms in the time of the Western Zhou: the Book of Odes, or Shi Jing, and the Book of Changes, or Yi Jing, which we already discussed last time. Its concern with divination points us even further back towards archaeological evidence about divination practices under the Shang Dynasty. Here, we should caution you that dynasties were not unified in the way you might expect, in that a period like the Shang does not designate sustained rule by just one extended family or royal house. Rather, power changed hands within each so-called dynasty. As these dynasties changed hands, the replacement of one with another was explained in terms of the mandate of heaven being passed from one to the next, due to the previous ruler's moral failures. With this caveat, it is still handy to try to remember the traditional names and dates of these dynasties. If all the dates are too much, you might just try to remember 770 BCE. It was then that a civil war between two successors to the throne were settled, resulting in the move of the Zhou court eastward to Shangzhou, near present-day Luoyang. With reference to this geographical shift, historians distinguish the earlier Western Zhou from the Eastern Zhou, whose run goes all the way from 770 to late in the 3rd century BCE. That sounds like a remarkable achievement of long-lasting and stable governance until you notice that this time span includes the aforementioned Warring States period. In fact, the time of the Eastern Zhou is subdivided into two. Firstly, the so-called Spring and Autumn period, Shunqiu, and then secondly, the Warring States. Although the last king of the Zhou dynasty was deposed and killed only in 256, during both the Spring and Autumn and Warring States periods, effective power slipped away from the kings to theoretically subordinate vassal states, these being the states that did all that warring with each other. The result was a breakdown in the feudal structures of the Zhou state, an increasing influence for the highly placed ministers who worked to advance the interests of their own individual states. One such minister was Zhang Yang, whose ideas later helped his own state, the Qin, to rise to power. Eventually, the Qin, whose name may be the etymological root of our English word China, would attain unchallenged supremacy, but only briefly. As an imperial dynasty, it survived only from 221 to 206 BCE, about the same length of time that the History of Philosophy podcast has been running. Xiangyang's proposed reforms included a new system of taxation and integration of the peasantry into the army. He's also blamed for helping to inspire a code of savage punishment that would be imposed under the Xin, which meted out execution and bodily mutilation for a range of infractions. Writers of the Han Dynasty, which succeeded the Qin, polemically blamed their political predecessors for the draconian nature of their regime, and argued that it was this that led to the dynasty's speedy fall after finally prevailing over the other warring states. In fact, though, the Qin laws were largely maintained under the Han. But what matters for us is not whether Xiangyang was admirable or brutal. It's the fact that he exemplifies a new class of politically engaged intellectuals called the Xu, scholars and men of service, who were the authors of many practical political and philosophical works in the period. One of them was the man we will, as we said in episode 1, call by his Chinese name Kongzi, meaning Master Kong. You may know him better under the Europeanized name Confucius. He never rose to become a ruler in his own right, which is a shame because then we could call him King Kong instead of Master Kong. But our texts do show him being sought out by rulers as a source of wisdom on such topics as ritual practice and political decision-making. In one anecdote, the Duke of Wei asks his advice on military tactics, but is met with the response, "I know about sacrificial vessels, but not armor and weaponry." After ending the interview with this polite but unhelpful response, Kongzi remarked, "A bird chooses its tree, but how can a tree choose its bird?" This alludes to the possibility that some scholars were free agents who moved from court to court, seeking leaders with potential for virtue and success, or failing that, just a leader who would offer them a job. We see this in Kongzi's own career. After serving as minister in the state of Lu, he was exiled and spent years as an itinerant sage hoping to find a morally receptive patron. The link between political engagement and maintaining critical detachment from existing norms is expressed in many classical Chinese texts. We heard in episode 2 that not only is it important to reflect critically on society's norms and practices, the exercise of moral discretion is a capacity of Confucian sages. For instance, one of the main Confucian works of the Warring States period, the Xunzi, is dismissive of acting simply in customary ways. In the Xunzi, custom refers to any set of beliefs and practices a society just happens to hold. This text offers the following classification of people in terms of the way they relate to customary practices. The common people unquestioningly follow custom. The lowest rank of scholar does not deviate from following good models. The more accomplished scholar not only follows good models, but seeks to cultivate and improve himself. And the true sage cultivates himself according to the 100 models of the sages, modifying them as needed, responding to the changes of times as easily as counting from 1 to 2. Of course, Confucian texts present Kongzi himself as the most ideal of sages, even if he didn't always have an easy time getting rulers to recognize it. The more canny rulers may have seen such scholars as a valuable resource, virtuous, wise, and learned. They could help keep the ship of state on an even keel, even as the sharks that were the other warring states circled menacingly. Some historians, like Xu Xiuyun, has even argued that the rise of philosophy in ancient China was an indirect result of the need for such a class of scholarly advisors. This would exemplify the social mobility that characterized the period. Whereas high-born elites had dominated under the Zhou, now relatively common people could come to serve the state. Peasants as soldiers, men with education but without noble lineage as advisors. But another historian of early China, Mark Edward Lewis, has expressed some skepticism about all this. He argues that philosophers were usually positioned outside the circles of government and as outsiders tended to complain about the policies of the administrators, like Xiangyang. It was this latter group that wielded real power, and the philosophers' focus on topics like poetry, ritual, and virtue marks their exclusion from that power. This is, of course, compatible with the idea that philosophers saw themselves as men who would be ideal advisors in matters of state if given half a chance. That's clear from the stories about Kongzi and makes sense of other philosophical movements too, for example, the Moists. Their policy of jianai, or inclusive care, can be applied by anyone, but its effects would be most powerful when applied by people who are, well, powerful. That passage from the Xunzi we just cited says something else about the perfect sage. he is someone who can cultivate the ways of the ancient kings as easily as distinguishing black from white. Here we have another feature that is prominent in classical Chinese philosophy, the valuing of history itself as a storehouse of knowledge and models for imitation. It's an implicit judgment on the parlous conditions of their own time that philosophers of the Spring and Autumn and Warring States periods often look back to the Western Zhou dynasty, or even earlier times, to find exemplars of virtue and piety. These might be early sages with whom the philosophers could identify, or they might be kings who could be held up as paradigms for the rulers of the current day. Lewis observes that two of the major Confucian texts have different emphasis in this regard, with the Mengzi tending to look back to sages and the Xunzi to the kings of Zhou. A figure who straddles that divide by being both a political actor and a sage is the so-called Duke of Zhou. This semi-legendary character was thought to have lived right around the time of the defeat of Shang at the hands of the Zhou, and served as regent for a boy king. He was one of the figures traditionally credited with producing the divinatory judgments found in the I Ching. Kongzi greatly admired him. In the Analects, he laments at his own decline, which is shown by the fact that it's been a long time since he had a dream about the Duke. The same section that contains this remark begins with a passage where Kongzi describes himself as a transmitter, not an innovator, who believes in and loves the ancients. If history was so important for the philosophers, you might ask, then why didn't they write about it? The answer is that they did, at least according to tradition. As we said, Kongzi was believed to have served as a minister of Lu, in addition to spending time as a wandering scholar. This made it plausible when subsequent authors credited him with authorship of a historical work so important that it gave its name to the historical period it covers, the Spring and Autumn Annals, Xunqiu. It purports to record events from 722 to 481 BCE, thus going right up to the dawn of the Warring States period. Kongzi was traditionally said to have died 2 years later in 479, so his authorship would be plausible in chronological terms. Naturally, then, a philosophically minded reader will want to crack open these annals and profit from the wisdom contained therein. But such a reader is likely to be disappointed. The work consists entirely of bluntly factual statements that record political, religious, and natural events. Here are some entries about the year 645, which we've chosen more or less at random to give you a feeling for the style. Gongsun Ao, commanding an army, together with grand officers of the other feudal lords, marched to the relief of the state of Chu. In the summer, during the fifth month, there was a solar eclipse. In the autumn, during the seventh month, the armies of the states of Qi and Qiao attacked the state of Li. During the eighth month, there was a plague of locusts. During the ninth month, the duke returned from the meeting. The youngest daughter took her place in the state of Zheng. Can we really believe that the great Kongzi would have written something this boring? Well, no, or at least modern scholars don't think he did. The fact that the events of the time are seen from the vantage point of the state of Lu shows that it did come from there, and it may be a set of official records kept by the state. This would explain why the annals are, as a recent book about the work puts it, lacking in description or literary merit. But the author of this book, Newell and Van Auken, also argues that they are more interesting than they seem. The terse style is misleading because it suggests a degree of neutrality or objectivity, whereas in fact, the compilers of the record are quietly communicating messages through such features as word choice, and of course their selection of what to include and what to leave out. For Van Auken, the primary concern of the spring and autumn is hierarchy, something she illustrates with the words used when someone in the narrative dies. There are three different verbs for dying in the annals, which vary not in terms of how someone died, as we might distinguish between passing away and being killed, but in terms of the rank of the deceased person. Thus, Zhou rulers get one word, Lu rulers and their wives another, and everyone else a third. The broader idea here, that the annals need to be read with exquisite sensitivity to every detail, is a very old one, almost as old as the annals themselves. With its high status as a work supposedly from the pen of Kongzi, these dry records attracted attention from commentators. This is a pattern we'll be seeing again and again, and one that echoes the development of philosophical literature in other cultures, including ancient India and Greece. Early texts were often nearly impenetrable. At the most basic level, they used antiquated language, and even once that hurdle was cleared, they tended to be compressed and elusive in meaning. So it was commonly stated that a canonized or authoritative text was in need of a commentary. Here in China, the canonical text is called Jing, which conveys the meaning of weaving, and the commentary is called Zhuan, meaning the delivery of a message. In the case of the Annals, there were a number of significant commentaries, of which we'd like to discuss two, the Gongyang Zhuan and the Zhuo Zhuan. The Gongyang commentary is named for Gongyang Gao, a scholar of the Warring States period, but it was set down by one of his descendants early in the Han Dynasty. Similarly, the Zhuo Zhuan is named after its purported author, in this case Zhuo Xunming, who was an associate of Kong Zi himself. The story goes that Zhuo was worried about the possible disappearance of historical knowledge that was being transmitted orally and took the trouble to write it down. Much later, a Han imperial archivist promoted the Zhuo Zhuan as the most valuable commentary on the annals, and it was duly canonized as such. Here it's worth pausing to notice how the Han period forms a kind of filter for our knowledge of earlier texts. As shown with the case of the commentaries on the annals, it was often Han scholars who produced the versions of these texts that survived down to the present day, and it is they who selected what was important enough to survive. We'll say a little more about this canonizing function at the end of today's episode. But first, let's look at these two commentaries on the Spring and Autumn Annals. They are markedly different in style. Like the annals themselves, the Gongyang commentary is terse and compressed, as it offers mostly very brief answers to questions a reader might have while going along through the text. The Zhuo Zhuan is more expansive and elaborates on the source text by offering additional stories and reflections. But the commentaries have several assumptions and concerns in common. First, the annals are indeed carefully written and pregnant with meaning. They observe great decorum, passing over unpleasant facts that might have seemed relevant, omitting to say which kind of animal is put to death in a sacrifice to avoid calling attention to the violence, and not mentioning explicitly that the son of an assassinated ruler ascends to the throne out of respect for wounded feelings. The commentaries assume that the annals condemns historical figures with the most subtle of means, often by using somewhat less respectful titles than might have been expected. What is not said is at least as significant as what is said. At one point, the Gongyang commentary even claims that if the annals fail to mention a crime we know to have been committed, this is a way of underscoring the gravity of that crime. This brings us to a second commonality, which is a pervasive concern with moral issues. The reader of the annals is not just supposed to learn what happened, but to benefit from moral instruction by seeing how people went right or wrong, usually wrong. The Zhuo Zhuan returns again and again to the value of li, which is often translated with a phrase along the lines of ritual propriety. This often makes sense, as when a given ritual is judged to violate li because it was overdone or underdone. And there are plenty of opportunities for such judgments since the annals have a habit of noting the observance of rituals alongside political and natural events. But the term li has far broader potential application, as when we are told that executing emissaries during a peace negotiation was against ritual propriety. Here, the translation feels rather out of place, but we might instead think that li has something to do with honor or just moral uprightness. The restrained and tactful way that the annals have been written is itself seen as an example of li, so that the commentator's assumptions about the moral qualities of the author govern their interpretation. As the Gongyang says, there is always a reason when the annals say even a little bit more or less. However we translate the term, it's clear that the observing of li is crucial to political success. A third feature of both commentaries is their concern with that success, or rather with its lack, given the instability that prevailed once the Zhou lost meaningful control over the various states in the Spring and Autumn period. Of course, scholars living in the Warring States period would have had at least as much reason to worry about that, and could be projecting their anxieties back onto the annals. The Gongyang commentary alludes to the disorder that results when there is no overall king who bears the supreme title Son of Heaven, Tianji. For example, it notes that a regional feudal lord is not supposed to dispense justice in his own right, but may need to do so when there is no Son of Heaven. Elsewhere, it speaks of more dire consequences. With no Son of Heaven above or leader of the feudal lords below, and all the feudal lords in the empire destroying one another, it is only on the basis of sheer power that states can be rescued. The commentator laments the way ministers were exercising the real power, as rightful rulers became mere figureheads, saying that the ministers were making their rulers as superfluous as tassels on a flag. The Zuotuan draws a close connection between these two themes of moral virtue and political harmony. It states outright that peace is made through ritual propriety, not through disorder, and contrasts mere observance of ceremony with true ritual propriety, by which one keeps the domain and does not lose one's subjects. Here we have an idea that is central in Confucianism, but found throughout classical Chinese philosophy, that it is the righteous ruler who succeeds politically. The Zuotuan advises, draw close to those who have ritual, rely upon the solid and stable, stay away from the disaffected and duplicitous, and overturn the benighted and disorderly. These are the instruments of the overlord. Obviously, this advice is too general to put to concrete use, but the commentary is not afraid to get more specific. For example, it recommends leniency, saying that if one does make a mistake, then better to err on the side of handing out too many rewards than being too harsh with punishments. The Gongyan has somewhat less to say in this direction, but is certainly not free of moralizing and political content. For example, it says that a wicked minister is no true minister. It advises that blame for evil should be placed with the culprit alone, whereas appreciation for good deeds can still be directed towards the descendants of those who performed them. It criticizes the introduction of the new land tax system and the way armies were organized in this period. And crucially, it says that the legitimate ruler is the one who displays virtue, not just the one who was born to the last ruler. In this way, both commentaries read the Annals as a philosophical treatise on morals and political rule, and in so doing, become such treatises in their own right. So, here at the start of our journey through classical Chinese philosophy, we're already discovering that there is philosophical material to be found beyond the works that would first leap to mind, the ones by authors like Kongzi, Mengzi, and Xunzi in the Confucian tradition, Mozi, the founder of Moism, and key figures of Taoism beginning with Laozi. In fact, the identification and organization of a canonical list of philosophical schools is itself a product of ancient Chinese history. It was scholars of the Han period, and especially Sima Qian in his Record of the Historian, or Xu Ji, written around 90 BCE, who laid down a list of so-called schools that emerged in the time of the Eastern Zhou. You may run across the idea that there were 100 such schools. Inevitably, we are going to follow their lead to some extent by covering Confucianism, Moism, Taoism, and other traditions besides, for instance, the Legalists, or Fa, group of thinkers, and the School of Names, Ming Jia. But you should be aware from the very start that the assigning of individual thinkers to schools, jia, defined in terms of consistent bodies of doctrine, is a retrospective reconstruction, and one that emerged within its own ideological context. In assessing this historiographical tradition, it's relevant to know that as a Han thinker, Sima Qian wanted to stress the fractured multiplicity of political life and thought in the Warring States period, in contrast to the harmonious unity that had been achieved by the Han. So, the Spring and Autumn Annals are not alone in having tacit messages to convey. That's something every historical work does, including every work on the history of philosophy. With that warning in mind, we'll continue to provide you with our own, necessarily partial view of the history of classical Chinese philosophy. Soon we'll be looking at texts whose core elements are even earlier than the Spring and Autumn Annals. But before that, we want to spend an episode on the more basic question of what even counts as a text in this historical period. How and in what context were classical Chinese writings produced? Why were they preserved? What were they even writing on? Fortunately, quite a bit of ink has been spilled on these topics in the form of scholarship that we've consulted in order to bring you the next episode of The History of Philosophy in China.